Today is Monday, January 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
Also ahead, as the partial U.S. government shutdown reaches its 31st day today, the Senate's Republican leader is preparing a vote on a proposal. It's all on today's International Edition. As the partial U.S. government shutdown reaches its 31st day today, the Senate's Republican leader is preparing a vote on a proposal that President Donald Trump is calling a compromise and Democratic leaders say is a non-starter. The president's plan would provide 3 years of protection against deportation for hundreds of thousands of immigrants who came to the country illegally when they were children, as well as extensions of protected status for people who fled their countries due to violence or natural disasters. In return, he would get the $5.7 billion in funding he wants to build a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border. Democrats say the border wall is an ineffective and expensive security solution. They want Trump and Republicans to again agree to reopen the government and then discuss other border security initiatives. While the shutdown continues, about 800,000 government workers are either continuing their jobs without pay or have been furloughed, while hundreds of thousands of the federal employees affected by the political battle are military veterans. According to the latest government data, veterans make up about a third of the federal government's civilian workforce. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb spent time with one veteran's family to see how they are coping without a paycheck.
It seems like a typical morning in the HomeQuest household. The kids pack their lunches, Carrie HomeQuest makes her morning coffee, and then it's off to school. But there's one major difference. Tyler HomeQuest, who works for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is still here. He's one of the hundreds of thousands of federal workers furloughed in the government shutdown, unable to work or collect pay.
You just start making adjustments. You start cutting, eating out. Try to make less trips to town, save on gas.
HomeQuest is a veteran, just like one of every three federal workers.
My dad.
He spent 24 years in the Marine Corps, continuing a family legacy of fighters.
And then behind you is my great-grandpa.
That dates back to World War One, and he views his job in the Department of Homeland Security as a continuation of his service.
Support and defend the Constitution, support and defend the nation, something a Marine could easily get behind.
Carrie has been out of the workforce for years, opting to stay home to care for the kids during Tyler's military deployments and the many family moves. But that soon could change.
Actually, I may be applying for jobs because, well, we don't know how long this is going to last.
HomeQuest employer, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is at the center of the political impasse fueling the furloughs.
You know what? A lot of the people that we're talking about in terms of pay, they agree with me.
You're those people he's referring to.
Right. I very much support a wall or barrier and better security. On the other hand, I'm starting to wake up at night and be stressed because we're not getting a paycheck.
They're hoping elected leaders will quickly do their jobs so Tyler can get back to his. Carla Babb, VOA News, Fredericksburg, Virginia.
Thank you, Carla. This is VOA's International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, Taliban insurgents launch a major suicide bomb and gun attack against a military base in central Afghanistan, killing at least 18 security troops and injuring dozens more. The EU imposes chemical weapons sanctions on 9 Russian and Syrian officials, including the chief of the GRU Military Intelligence Agency. Russia's communication watchdog opens administrative proceedings today against Facebook and Twitter for noncompliance with the country's data laws. And a 6.7 magnitude earthquake that hit north-central Chile late Saturday has killed at least two people and left thousands temporarily without power. Well, expanded coverage of these stories and more are on VOANews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A 2012 report by the CDC says 30% of Americans aren't getting enough sleep. A number of studies have reinforced just how important getting a good night's sleep is for your health. But a new report suggests a possible association of a late stillbirth with women who tend to get more than 9 hours of undisturbed sleep each night during pregnancy. The study's lead author, Louise O'Brien of the University of Michigan, says pregnant women often report waking and getting up several times in the middle of the night. She says that while some might be concerned with having their sleep disturbed, in the context of stillbirth, these sleep interruptions appears to be protective. O'Brien and her fellow authors stress that further research is needed to better understand the connection between long periods of uninterrupted sleep and what it means for a pregnant woman. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The third annual Women's March on Washington attracted a smaller turnout than the original event in 2017, held just one day after President Donald Trump's inauguration. But Saturday's event was no less rollicking as women and men marched through the nation's capital amid considerable controversy leading up to the rally. VOA's Anna Cook has details.
Braving winter winds and cold rain, thousands of men and women across the nation gathered in the streets of Washington to champion issues ranging from the partial government shutdown and the president's border wall to women's reproductive rights and gender equality. Mia Ives-Rubley, a transracial Korean-American woman who is disabled, has been involved in planning this year's march and says she is fighting to gain more rights for all of her identities.
My hope, you know, is to continue to talk about how these different identities interact, how we can support each other, and how it's so important that we are able to talk about disability, especially in the Asian American communities.
Sophie Elman Golan, the deputy head of communications for the Women's March, says compared to previous years, this year's march is different because they are pushing ahead with a solid agenda.
Really specific policy demands, and that's, of course, the women's agenda that we released yesterday. It was crafted by a policy table of about 50 to 70 women, movement experts, policy experts from really all backgrounds.
The recent disputes surrounding the leaders of the Women's March regarding allegations of anti-Semitism didn't prevent some women from turning out to support the demonstration. Shelley Tygielski is from Florida.
I'm actually a Jewish Israeli, and I know that it's controversial for people like me to be here today because of all the controversy surrounding the Women's March, but I'm not giving up my seat at the table, and I'm here to make sure that anti-Semitism is something that is addressed and part of the Women's March agenda.
Even with a record number of women elected to Congress last November, both men and women here Saturday say there is much more to be accomplished. Aaliyah Phillips is from Maryland.
So I almost cried like when I heard that they all got like put in. And I was just so happy, but like we still gotta make the moves. We have so many firsts now, and I'm just so happy about that. But like we still gotta bring the punches. We got some work left.
Alex Finall is from Virginia.
Everybody supports women. It's not just the people being oppressed. It's all of us. This is one community, one voice. If you are gonna trample on their rights, even though they're not me, that's still important to me.
In addition to Washington's rally, sister marches took place in multiple cities across the country, including New York and Los Angeles. Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Thank you, Jim, for that report. Well, in a rare public admission, Israel confirmed early today that it carried out airstrikes on Iranian military targets inside Syria. The Israeli military said the strikes came in response to Iranian forces launching a surface-to-surface rocket from Syria aimed at the Golan Heights. Israel said its airstrikes targeted a military site at the Damascus airport, as well as Iranian training and munitions storage sites and Syrian missile defense sites. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said today that Israel will strike anyone who tries to harm it. His comments followed an earlier report on a website linked to Iran's state television, quoting the head of Iran's Air Force as saying Iran was impatient to fight Israel and destroy it. Well, heads of UN and international aid agencies will use the World Economic Forum's influential platform to present humanitarian and human rights issues on behalf of millions of people caught in conflict, poverty, and natural disasters. The forum begins its annual week-long meeting today. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Economic Forum is best known for the many high-powered government and business leaders who make the annual pilgrimage to Davos to acquire lucrative deals and shape geopolitical events. But the annual event also presents a robust humanitarian agenda. This year, the Forum, World Bank, and International Committee of the Red Cross will launch a humanitarian investing initiative. The aim is to seek new solutions for protracted humanitarian crises by moving from short-term to long-term funding to support fragile communities. United Nations aid agencies will feature prominently during the week-long meeting. The World Food Program's Executive Director, David Beasley, will co-host events such as Conflict and Hunger and the use of digital technology in the humanitarian sector. WFP spokesman Hervé Verhoosel says the group will be seeking support for its operations. He says many of the companies attending Davos understand that investments in food security are fundamental to business success.
It saves lives and builds stronger markets around the world. In fact, it can increase GDPs by up to 16.5% and a person's lifetime earnings by 46%.
With more than 3,000 of the world's movers and shakers from 110 countries present, aid agencies see the forum as a valuable opportunity to strengthen relationships with world leaders and keep their life-saving missions on the world's agenda. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, will be attending events on a wide range of topics. Her spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, says these include LGBTI or lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex standards in businesses and human rights and democracy in a changing world.
A couple of events on women's rights as human rights and female leadership, the importance of women playing a role in global affairs by creating a new architecture that allows them to fully participate as leaders and shapers.
The head of the UN Children's Fund, Henrietta Fore, will champion the needs of children and young people who are caught up in humanitarian crises or are being left behind because of extreme poverty and lack of development. UN Development Program Administrator Achim Steiner will seek to raise $100 million from Davos's wealthy clientele to protect wild animals and their habitats. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Well, first-term California Senator Kamala Harris announced today she is seeking the Democratic Party's 2020 presidential nomination to oppose President Donald Trump, joining the crowded field of Democratic candidates seeking to end his presidency after a single term in the White House. Harris, a daughter of immigrant parents from Jamaica and India, portrayed herself as a fighter for justice, decency, and equality in announcing her candidacy in a campaign video and on ABC's Good Morning America. Today's announcement coincided with the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, which recognizes the slain civil rights leader. Harris is a former attorney general in California, the Pacific Rim state that has become the center of resistance to Trump's four-year White House tenure. In Washington, Harris is 2 years into her six-year Senate term, has become known as a sharp questioner of Trump's key appointments to his administration. If the 54-year-old Harris is eventually successful, she would become the first woman U.S. president, the first of Asian heritage, and the second African American. The next U.S. presidential election is on November 3, 2020. Well, as mentioned, today is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the U.S. It's a day officially set aside to honor the late civil rights leader for his role in ending legal racial segregation in America. Here he is at his last speech on April 3, 1968, at the Mason Temple Church in Memphis, Tennessee. It would be his last speech.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say we aren't gonna let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't gonna let any injunction turn us around.
King was assassinated the next day, and while he was a civil rights leader, King was far more than an activist. He was also a Christian minister motivated by the moral teachings of Jesus and the Bible. But what many Americans do not know is that King's nonviolent tactics came from far off India, where the Hindu spiritual leader Mahatma Gandhi had recently led his country to independence from the British. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Professor Claiborne Carson, founding director of Stanford University's Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute.
Martin Luther King was influenced by Gandhi because as a person concerned about civil rights issues, he was looking for a strategy that would mobilize people into a source of power. And he understood the Christian message about love thy neighbor. And with Gandhi, he sensed that if he mobilized enough people around nonviolence, then that would be a source of political power. You could speak truth to power. After all, Gandhi in Martin Luther King's lifetime had mobilized the Indian nation to gain independence from the strongest power of that era. And Martin Luther King was the beneficiary of all of that. He absorbed that message.
And what is that message in a nutshell?
I think what it is in essence is oppressed people saying, we're not going to tolerate this. We're not going to try to meet force with force, but we can refuse to accept oppression. And we can do something that's going to disrupt that relationship. Whether that's a sit-in or a freedom ride or a demonstration, we will mobilize what Martin Luther King referred to as our soul force as a way of achieving our human rights.
It's always been striking to me how Gandhi and Martin Luther King fought for a universal peace and justice, but they both stood solidly within their own religious traditions.
Well, their message was rooted in their faith, but they were also critical of their faith. Gandhi was critical of the way what were called untouchables at that time were treated by people within the Hindu faith, the caste system, and he wanted to move beyond that aspect of religion. And Martin Luther King was also a critic, just like the Old Testament prophets were critics of Judaism. They were saying, you're not truly following the message of God. Both of them had the view that this was your obligation to try to use that faith and that commitment and that belief in a way that makes our society reflect the deeper values, egalitarian values of most religions, but recognizing that religion has also produced hierarchies of power. So you have to be critical of your own religious tradition in order to fight against that hierarchy within the religion. So they start as critics of their religious tradition, but they're also building on that religious tradition as a tool to change the world. And I think both of them succeeded in doing that.
I know King was often criticized and even ridiculed by some other civil rights leaders when he invoked Christ's words to turn the other cheek when your enemy strikes you.
But that's only part of the message. You know, the Good Samaritan story is another example of King taking a message that comes from the Bible and turning it into an actual political statement. What would it mean in today's world to help the wounded stranger along the side of the road? Treating that stranger as if that stranger were God, or treating other people as if they had the light of God in them. That is a very powerful message when it's applied to social issues such as poverty. King used that in the context of the Poor People's Campaign.
I know that for both men, the struggle for civil rights broadened into a call for human rights for everyone. For example, when King was assassinated in Memphis, he was there to support striking sanitation workers, not African Americans per se.
One of the things that was true about both of them is that they were involved in movements that could be described as movements for equal citizenship. For African Americans, it was getting rid of discrimination that was preventing us from becoming first-class citizens. It wasn't trying to change the rights of people outside the United States. For Gandhi, it was getting rid of colonial status and having a nation of your own. But both of them had ideals that went beyond that. What are the universal rights of people wherever they are, everybody in the world, regardless of their citizenship, but whether they have no citizenship, should have the right to pursue happiness. And every person has rights that are worthy of being respected.
Can you give me an example of this transition for each of the men?
When Gandhi was able to gain the independence of India, he became critical of the direction that India was going because he knew that citizenship was not going to free the people in the countryside of India. And in the same way, King, after the passage of civil rights legislation, he said that we need to move towards solving the problems of poverty, which is a global problem, and we need to end the scourge of war and violence, and we have to do it understanding that we can't solve them in one country without dealing with the same problem globally. Human rights is based on the notion that ultimately all of us are just human beings.
That was Professor Claiborne Carson, founding director of Stanford University's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute. Well, stargazers around the world were treated to a rare super blood wolf moon lunar eclipse in the night skies late Sunday. The triple astronomical phenomenon occurred when the moon, the sun, and the earth lined up simultaneously to create a so-called super blood wolf moon. During the eclipse, the full moon became a supermoon as it appeared a little bigger and brighter thanks to its slightly closer position to the Earth. The moon's surface also turned red from sunlight scattering off Earth's atmosphere. The eclipse was visible throughout North and South America, as well as parts of Europe. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. And thanks for joining us. And thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and engineer, John Dryden. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, an update on the U.S. political landscape. In 2019, Democrats are set to take over the majority in the lower chamber of Congress. How will they yield their newfound authority? What's the latest on the Russia probe and its impact on President Trump and the life and legacy of former President George H.W. Bush? That's Encounter on The Voice of America.